Welcome to this episode of Just the Disc. My name is Ryan Sauer. This is my podcast about Blu-rays. We are in the month of August, the later summer, and I have my buddy Rob Galuzzo here for New Arrivals. Hey, Rob.
Hello, man. August. This is my birthday month.
Oh, happy early birthday, sir.
Thank you. Very excited.
Yeah, it's going to be a good month for you, I think.
I think so. Last month was great. You know, we had a new Spider-Man movie. We had a new Quentin Tarantino movie. It's a good summer.
Damn right. I think.
Good summer. And last month, we also had a Criterion sale. So I wonder, will any Criterion titles appear on today's picks
from either of us? You have been, like I've said many times, I follow your socials, and whenever I see the Blu-rays, I'm always like, ooh, is that a potential for the show? Is that a potential?
I know.
And I just, there's so many that there's no way I could ever know.
I rather enjoy keeping you on your toes. However, I cannot predict from your stacks because your stacks are bigger than my stacks. Any way you slice it.
I've told you this too, that I shuffle these lists. Like, I'll do my initial list and then I'll watch some things and then I'll go, oh, you know what? This just isn't, you know, New Arrivals, Rob G level stuff. I need better stuff. And
wow.
So I actually sometimes lose. Like, I had two picks that I initially slated for this group that I watched and I was like, nah, it's good, but it's not. And then you're going to hear a couple of the ones on the list and be like, really? That beat out what? You know? So anyway, why don't we get into it here? I'm curious what's in your stack. If there's Criterion, if there's not, I am delighted to know.
Yes, spoiler alert, there is Criterion.
All right.
I will kick us off with a Criterion title, but not the one you might expect. I finally picked up after, I don't know what took me so long, but I picked up The Breakfast Club, a John Hughes film.
All right, people, we're going to try something a little different today. We are going to write an essay of no less than 1,000 words, describing to me who you think you are.
This is a test?
And when I say essay, I mean essay. I do not mean a single word repeated 1,000 times. Is that clear, Mr. Bender?
Crystal.
Good. Maybe you'll learn a little something about yourself. Maybe you'll even decide whether or not you care to return.
You know, I can answer that right now, sir. You know, that'd be no for me, because...
Sit down, Johnson.
Thank you, sir.
My office is right across that hall. Any monkey business is ill-advised. Any questions?
Yeah, I got a question. Does Barry Manilow know that you raid his wardrobe?
Give you the answer to that question, Mr. Bender, next Saturday. Don't mess with the bull, young man. You'll get the horns.
That man is a brownie hound.
Oh, nice.
And man, oh man, do I love this disc. I think it was because I've already owned this. But I just read so much stuff online about how the universal transfers for a lot of these John Hughes movies are not very good compared to these newer editions that are coming out. So, like, this came out, I believe Arrow is doing a UK version of 16 Candles and a US and UK version of Weird Science. This, I just was like, you know what, it's The Breakfast Club. I love this movie. I'm sure the features are worth it. And sure enough, this transfer's terrific. It's a much better looking version of the movie. And I can't believe it, but Breakfast Club made me go back and double dip all my Criterion. Like, I had no intention of buying these titles. I went back for the sale last month and I got Blue Velvet, Breakfast Club, Silence of the Lambs. Basically anything I've already owned, I've now rebought because the Criterion transfer is always going to be better than whatever's out there already. So
it's true.
So that's for starters, is you got an incredible transfer of arguably one of John Hughes' best films. I think it might be his best film, although my personal favorite would be Weird Science.
Mm.
But this is my, I think it's probably, this is probably his best.
Yeah, I think so too.
And I got to tell you, the wealth of extras on this just absolutely blew me away. So the one thing that most people were really excited about is that there was always a rumored, I don't know, 3-hour cut of this movie. There was like a lot of extra material.
Yeah.
They never restored it, but there is something like 55 minutes worth of deleted scenes and alternate takes. And the quality on that is basically ST. It's not like great, but it's just fascinating and interesting to see, especially within context of the film. And again, it's great to spend an hour watching this extra stuff, which, again, if you don't know what the hell The Breakfast Club is about, it is basically the epitome of 80s teenage angst. Is it five kids spending detention together that are totally, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. Yes. That are totally different personalities and that find some common ground, over the course of one afternoon. So it's a great, great, snapshot at what it's like to be a teenager, no matter what time period you watch it in. Like, I think your kids would understand it, or, it's just one of those movies. So the deleted scenes are interesting to watch, but I understand why they were deleted. Even like the extended stuff, it's so funny, especially with comedy. Comedy, it's all timing. So a lot of these longer versions of these scenes, I don't think would be nearly as funny or have the impact if they weren't truncated and edited the way they are in the final film. I was talking about this on Twitter, and somebody was like, "Oh, it's a shame there's not the 3-hour version of the movie." It's like, no, it's not. That, like, the watchable movie of the movie is the movie. It's fun to see this extra stuff, but I wouldn't want it edited back into the movie. I just like it on its own. But anyways, that's the deleted scenes. But really, the gold on here, and hold up, I actually have notes today, so I'm going to pull them up. There's so much material on here. So there's a documentary from 2008 called Sincerely Yours. This was on a previous DVD version, and this basically brings everybody back. So Judd Nelson, Anthony Michael Hall. There's brand new interviews with Molly Ringwald and Ally Sheedy, which were shot in about 2017 in New York. And those are pretty terrific. I mean, it's also interesting to hear Molly Ringwald, because I think this might have been after she did a pretty controversial interview with Bret Easton Ellis, who really pushed her buttons about her relationship with John Hughes, which, I don't know, I thought was a little on the inappropriate side on his behalf. But interviewers are interviewers, so they'll ask what they want. But it's good to hear her here talking candidly about obviously a working relationship with a director that meant a tremendous amount to her. And really, it's just the level of depth they go into with a lot of old school photos. Like, there's photos of his mixtapes, which drove me like bananas. I was like, is so cool. Because he made mixtapes for every movie. Like, he was a very music savvy guy, and that's kind of how his soundtracks came together, was he would actually make physical cassette mixtapes. So I did a screen grab of that and put it online. And on top of that, so, speaking of that, there's two audio interviews with John Hughes on here. And one is actually, I think, a radio show from 1999 talking about specifically his love of music.
It seemed like you were always thinking in terms of how you were able to work music and musical elements into your movies. They were an integral part of your scripts, it seemed like, as opposed to just sort of being sort of glommed on at the end to sell a movie or something like that. The whole relationship between images and music seemed to be totally your thing. I mean, where did that come from? How did you sort of develop that?
Well, I would rather have been a musician than anything else, And when I was in high school, I wasn't the most popular person. And I found solace in music, and in having my own taste and my own style. I loved finding a band that nobody else had heard of yet. And when I got a chance to make pictures, I was determined to get the music right.
So the idea of using music in these films that you were scripting and directing was sort of a natural extension of that. I mean, to me, what was intriguing about your movies was that early on, I mean, nobody knew who Simple Minds was before The Breakfast Club, except for the hardcore fans.
Yeah.
So you must have somehow been among that hardcore elite that found out about Simple Minds before anybody knew.
Or what were your criteria for choosing songs? How did you?
It was what I was
out?
Listening to. I discovered when I was in high school, I discovered Melody Maker, and I could take the train downtown, go to State and Randolph. There was a big newsstand there that had out of town papers, and I'd pick up Melody Maker and the Musical Express from England. And I noticed that the charts were different. And there were all these, number one song in England was not the same as the number one song in America. And I thought, well, where can I get this band? So there were little ads that would say, "We export." So I would, I got like pretty things, I had the, you know, the Who album very early. Mm-hmm. I had the Who album at the same time Rubber Soul came out. Because Rubber Soul came and I said, goodbye. Too many acoustic guitars, I'm leaving. You know? No, I was 15 and, you know, you don't want... Norwegian Wood wasn't any good at 15. You know, it didn't, gotcha. Didn't go quite hard enough. So I, you know, I'd always maintained that connection to the import record world. And I discovered there's a wonderful record store here in town called Wax Trax. It was on...
Lincoln Avenue.
It was on Lincoln, yeah, by the Biograph. Mm-hmm. And every Sunday I'd go down there and buy my load of records and go home and make a 90-minute cassette tape, which in those days I could. You know, there was so much music, you know, right, in the 70s, late 70s, early 80s. I just, you know...
You go to that new release of singles bin, right?
You know, it was those, it was right, those British singles. And some of those... And you know, I used to buy ska records that were hand-stamped. Mm-hmm. Yeah. They probably pressed 500 of them.
Right.
Know? And I, you know, I built a huge collection, and I... It was the only thing I ever took care of, you know.
Oh, that's great.
And I had never heard of it or anything. I've never even heard. I mean, I've very rarely heard his voice because he was a pretty dry guy in general. I actually kept the very first iteration of Ferris Bueller on DVD. I still have because it has a John Hughes commentary on it.
Which didn't get ported over to the Blue for
it's
some reason.
Never, or it's the strange follow-up DVD. There was another DVD after that was like a special edition. And so that commentary has been kind of lost to that first edition. So I held on to that. But anyways, hearing him talk about music and how it plays into his films, there's like a 1985 NBC Today show with the Brat Pack, as you will, showing up. So it's so fun when Criterion does a release like this that's so all-encompassing, that looks at the movie right now, looks at it back when it was made, and just like even from an audio perspective, I kind of like that they're including podcasts and audio interviews and things like that. Yeah, I mean, there's even a segment called Describe the Ruckus, which is Judd Nelson reading John Hughes production notes over a bunch of stills that mostly none of which I've seen before. So on top of just the movie itself, this is one of like the most jam-packed and rewarding special editions that Criterion's ever done. Like, it really does embellish your love of this particular movie and every aspect of it. So if you haven't picked it up, you should. If you haven't upgraded it, you should. If you can wait for a Criterion sale, great. But I think it's worth every penny. So this should be added to your collection right away, the Breakfast Club Criterion Edition.
Couldn't agree more, man. Couldn't agree more. Great, great disc. My wife and I talked about it a long time ago when it first came out, and yeah, it was great to go down that rabbit hole, like you say, and see those deleted scenes. But I totally agree, especially with a classic like that that I've seen so many times. I was like, no, I just don't want this in there. And there's even part of me that doesn't even want to know this exists, but does at the same time. It's weird.
Well, one of my biggest pet peeves, especially in the Blu-ray world, is when they'll release a comedy as extended version or director's cut or whatever it is and not make the original available, and it's not as funny. Like, comedy is totally timing and pacing. And a perfect example is Dumb and Dumber. Like, I've kept my original DVD in that little snap clamshell thing because that's the only way to get the theatrical cut. That's They've crazy. Like added all these extended jokes that are not funny. And so I hate watching the Blu-ray version of that movie because it's not the one that I've seen a million times on VHS and on cable. Oh, so yeah, when it comes to comedies, I don't think you should touch it at all.
Yeah, I agree. Shorter is better with comedies, certainly, but most movies for that matter.
Yeah.
All right. Well, for my first pick here, I've got one from Mr. William Friedkin, and this is The Brink's Job from 1978.
1949. Every safe in the city of Boston was flush with post-war prosperity. And every cracker in town was looking to peel the right peat.
Benny, did you get downstairs and heat up the fire?
The money was easy for anyone with a steady hand and a brain in his head.
We're surrounded! Let's get the hell out of here!
Then there was Tony Pino.
Got any Chianti?
Nah, I don't keep that cheap stuff in the house.
Why don't you get it? I'm better off without it. The building is asleep, and all that money is in here, and it's being held prisoner. And it's screaming at me through the walls. It's yelling, hey, Tony, come in and grab me. Get me out of here.
The Brink's Job. A crime so insane, nobody in their right mind would go in on it. And nobody in their right mind did.
I was in the joint. They got cheap locks and 75-watt bulbs.
What if they got radar?
What's radar?
Peter Falk is Tony Pino.
What about the letter?
A small-time booster with plenty of talent and no luck. Yeah. Alan Gorowitz is his brother-in-law, Vinny. Jerry Murphy is Sandy. Paul Savino is Jazz, the bookie. Warren Oates is Specky O'Keefe. Kevin O'Connor is Gus, the lookout. And Peter Boyle is Joe, the exchange man.
Frankly, no one thinks you'll pull it off.
Who's no one?
Everyone.
So this one is his follow-up to Sorcerer. And it's interesting because it's kind of a comedy, but kind of drama. It's basically about this incredible real-life robbery that happened on January 17th, 1950, where a bunch of like small-time, you know, thieves, criminals, but like blue-collar guys that, you know, were always kind of looking to make a buck, they stumbled on the fact that the Brinks Company, the armored car company in New York, their headquarters, like they, I guess what had really happened is that they had relied so much on their reputation as this impenetrable, you know, reliable service that they just, they stopped really having a lot of security in their own building. So like they didn't lock the doors. The vault room had like one alarm that was like really hard to set off. And the idea is that, you know, the character, the main character played by Peter Falk, this movie has a really great cast, by the way, sort of stumbled upon this and, you know, decided to give it a shot. And they ended up getting away with, I can't remember if it was like $2 million or how much was the robbery. It was the biggest robbery in the history of the United States at the time. It was a whole lot of money, and it was apparently pretty easy, like to the point where I was listening to the commentary track and they were talking about like how the one of the guys from the heist, like, I think was like sort of peddling the story around and was like, hey, don't you want to make a movie out of this, trying to get in touch with Hollywood people. And I can't remember how it got into Friedkin's hands, but they were embellishing things about the robbery, apparently, because it was like kind of boring. Like, it was just so easy for them to finally pull it off that they had to kind of come up with some business for them to do. But anyway, the group is really great. So it's Peter Falk, Peter Boyle, Alan Garfield, Warren Oates, Paul Sorvino, and Jenna Rollins. And then there's some other little character actors that you'll notice here and there. But it's really a fun movie to watch, just because you see these guys, you know, in their quote-unquote slightly earlier career as criminals. They get caught, they go to jail, and then you see them trying to figure out this, you know, Brinks thing, and you're like, oh man, it is easy, but they're going to fuck it up. Like, this is, it's not quite Keystone Cops, because it is, like, very funny, but not totally wacky. And then it goes into some slightly darker places, as Friedkin is wont to do. But I really like it, and it's one that has had a spotty history on home video. It was on VHS, and then it was on MOD DVD, but, you know, not until relatively recently. I want to say in the past 10 years. So it kind of dropped out of people's idea of what, you know, is part of Friedkin's filmography. And I really think it's a solid movie, and the cast alone, you know, really makes it worthwhile for me. But I also like a good heist movie too. Yeah. It is, the screenwriter's name is Waylon Greene, and he also wrote The Wild Bunch, which I think is interesting. And then Warren Oates is really great in this movie. Not that he's not great in every movie, but he plays kind of a guy with like PTSD. He served in the military, and he is like trying to sell, they somehow get hooked up with him, and he's trying to sell them on the idea of like using military weapons like bazookas to try and blow the safe up. And he's like very antsy and nervous, which is kind of funny in some parts, and then other parts it's just like uncomfortable. So it's a really great role for him. But Peter Falk kills it in the main role, and I love Peter Boyle a lot, and he's like sort of a local not a crime boss, but like a guy who gets involved with different heists, but usually doesn't do them himself. He sort of either comes up with the idea or helps bankroll it or whatever. And so they have their own gang, Peter Falk and these other dudes, and he kind of like ingratiates himself. And anyway, it's a lot of fun and it's underseen. So for Friedkin fans, I definitely recommend it. It has an audio commentary with film historians Howard S. Berger, Steve Mitchell, and Nathaniel Thompson. And these guys are great. They have a lot of really interesting observations about, you know, some things that Friedkin does stylistically. God, they were talking about like wide shots versus close-ups and how he does a specific kind of thing with the editing and the shots where he'll start with the whole group and then I think get tighter and tighter on them or something. I can't remember now what they were saying, but I was like, oh wow, that's really cool. It's this thing that he's doing and I hadn't even thought about it. Plus it's Friedkin coming off what is arguably one of his best movies ever. So I feel like, you know, like John Carpenter in Christine coming off of The Thing, I feel like there's so much residual greatness in him as a filmmaker that you can't help but make a really interesting movie. And I think that's what this is. So anyway, that's The Brink's Job from Kino Lorber Studio Classics. That's my number one.
Super cool. And that's definitely a blind spot for me in Friedkin's filmography. So yeah, I'm gonna have to check that disc out.
Yeah, it's a lot of fun. Like I said, not a lot of people have seen it, I think, because of a lack of availability for so long. So this is great that Kino picked it up.
Cool. So my next pick is from Vinegar Syndrome, believe it or not. And I got to tell you, I was really impressed with their, you know, they put out something like four or five titles every month. And you never know what you're going to get. But July was really impressive because it was a lot of not necessarily horror titles, but just like some interesting cult titles. This is one I've heard about for a long time. I never watched it until I got this disc, and that's Putney Swope.
Oh, nice.
Putney Swope is the new chairman of this board.
Your father was a horse's ass. So let's go take care of business. You do that.
We did.
You fired.
I won't have nothing to do with war toys or cigarettes, and do something about your breath.
Now what are you doing, taking a temperature? That's why you're taking the next elevator. Shouldn't you be in school?
Fuck you! And fuck the establishment! And fuck you people who are trying to make me part of the unestablished establishment!
All right, I'll pick you up tomorrow at 11 o'clock. I'll take you to the zoo, then we'll go to the ball game. I can get anybody for nothing. Take a walk. Who you think you are, Lawrence of Nigeria? Get out of here! I never chase foul balls. Who did that?
You did. It was your idea.
Not bad. Not bad. Out, Odinga. You're finished. Wanna have din-din?
I wanna do something more creative.
Pick up your severance pay.
I feel like an Oreo cookie. You look like a pile of shit.
President Mimeo.
How did you guess?
I used to be an exterminator. That's why you get less money. Because you don't think. What do you got to say for yourself, Sonny?
Yes, directed by Robert Downey Sr. So, yes, that is Robert Downey Jr.'s father. The one of the biggest movie stars on the planet is Iron Man. His dad made some interesting counterculture cinema back in the 60s and 70s. And so this is basically, I guess you would call it a satirical comedy.
Yeah.
It's a really weird movie. But basically, Putney Swope is this, the sole black executive from a giant Madison Avenue, like advertising firm. And in kind of a silly round table, discussion at the beginning, one of the chairman drops dead and they're like, we need to vote somebody else in. And so everybody votes for him, assuming that nobody would vote for him. And so he ends up taking over the company. He fires all the elderly white people and changes the name of it to Truth and Soul Inc. and then basically starts, doing all these, subversive, like, campaigns through the advertising company. And it's a really bizarre movie. I mean, a good chunk of it's in black and white. And then there's certain sequences that go into color. And I've just never seen anything quite like it. I have a complete blind spot for Robert Downey Sr. I'm pretty sure Criterion had done a lot of his work in some sort of collection.
Yeah, there's a Eclipse box set, DVD only, that has, I think, like four or more films. And there's some good stuff in that set. So that's kind of cool.
Yeah, it's just, this is something I just did not expect Vinegar Syndrome to put out. And I, you know, I worked in the cult section at Amiibo when I worked there. And this was always one of those titles that everyone would pick up and talk about. And so it was great to finally see it. I didn't realize, like, Mel Brooks apparently has a tiny cameo in there. I totally missed it.
Nice.
And more importantly, this is like a flawless high definition presentation of it. And the title card that comes up right at the beginning says that this restoration was completely funded and done by George Lucas and his production company, which I thought was super cool. I was like, way to go, George.
Wow.
So this is a wild movie, and they've carted over a bunch of, I don't know if these were on the DVD. I have to assume they were. But on top of a new 4K scan, there's a commentary with Robert Downey Sr. There's interviews with him both from 2001 and 2008. I watched the more recent one just because I was curious. A Q&A he did at a film screening in 2005. And, you know, some other stuff. There's another audio commentary from a film critic, historian named Sergio Mims. I haven't had a chance to listen to that one yet.
Sergio Mims, nice.
Yeah. So this was a very pleasant surprise, both from Vinegar Syndrome and just in general as a little slice of satirical cult cinema.
Yeah. No, it's a very interesting movie and one that P.T. Anderson is a big fan of.
Yeah.
He's the one who turned me on to it originally, and I was just looking... There is something from the Criterion Collection's YouTube. There's a Robert Downey Sr. and Paul Thomas Anderson interview about seven and a half minutes, which I'm surprised didn't make it on the disc, but maybe Criterion owns it. So
yeah,
but you can find this on YouTube, so definitely go look it up. Just look up Robert Paul Thomas Anderson Putney Swope, and you'll find it. I'll just drop in a little clip of it.
What's the most successful film you've made, Putney?
I think so, yeah, because that really got distributed.
Were you making an effort to sort of make a slightly more normal?
You mean Putney Swope?
Yeah.
No, in fact, nobody wanted that film.
Right.
I mean, the other ones at least got in the Bleecker Street. People said, what? Uh-uh.
Right.
And the producer, the money guy, had one more screening for some distributors. And just as the film was ready to start, this guy was banging on the door of the screening room. And I said, fuck him, he's late, whoever he is, you know. And it's like, bang, bang, bang. I went to the door and I said, who are you? And he said, I'm Don Rugoff. And I said, so? And he said, I know I'm late, but I'm sorry. And so he came in. And after the screening, he came up to me and he said, I don't understand it, but I like it. And he opened it like a month later because he owned the theaters. And when they brought that ad out with this, that went up all over the city and it had some action.
I've made a few innovations, but not enough. I have a feeling that there's a lot of untapped talent around here. So beginning right now, I want each and every one of you to conceive, write, produce, and execute your own campaign.
I'm beginning to appreciate these films again.
And if you don't feel that you're the creative type, then pitch in and help somebody else with what they're doing.
But I've always been fascinated with it because of P.T. Anderson's fandom for it. So
yeah,
it's definitely one that I picked up, and I haven't got a chance to watch this new version, but I love that, not surprisingly, Vinegar Syndrome did a great job with the transfer, so that's awesome.
Oh, yeah. It's a flaw. I mean, black and white always tends to look great in high def, but it's a pretty flawless restoration. So I think you're going to love it when you see it.
That's very cool. It's like kind of one of those like important movies in a way, in terms of like, you know, where it comes in the late 60s and that it's kind of got a message, and it's just one of those movies that I'm glad is available in a nice edition now, Criterion or not, you know.
Yeah, for sure.
Good stuff. Actually, I had that on my potential list for next month's thing, so you got ahead of me. That's great. I love it.
Beat you to it.
Beat me to it. But all right, so I am going to jump into, I've got a small group here of science fiction and horror movies, mostly older ones, that will be basically the rest of my list.
Okay.
But All right, so
I thought you were going to say they were basically going to be your number three. No, you can't do that. You can't, no. You know, pick multiple ones.
Five movies for my number three. No, so I'm going to start with a new Val Lewton movie from Scream Factory, and it is called The Leopard Man from 1943.
Well, I'd best be off. Oh, sorry. Something I wanted to ask you. It's about the leopard.
Are you worrying about its killing someone else?
Not me. I'm not worried about anything.
And why did you come on the posse this morning? You've got some strange notions, Jerry. Why do you feel you must seem hard and disinterested? This morning I heard you tell Robles you didn't want to come, and yet you came along. That wasn't easy for a tenderfoot like you.
Listen, Gabriel, where I was brought up, you had to be tough. It was a tough neighborhood. I learned it didn't pay to let anybody know how you feel or really think. All right, so I feel rotten nervous. I want to go out, be every place at once. Be sure that cat doesn't hurt anyone else.
It's a wild animal. Do you think a wild animal prefers walls, streets, and people when it can get into open country?
Sure, that's right, isn't it?
Don't feel so concerned, Jerry. I've learned one thing about life. We're a good deal like that ball dancing on the fountain. We know as little about the forces that move us and move the world around us as that empty ball does. About the water that pushes it into the air, lets it fall and catches it again. You shouldn't feel too bad about Teresa Delgado.
This is one of my favorites. I don't know if I like it quite as much as The Body Snatcher, but it's really up there for me as one of my favorite Lewton productions. And it is directed by Jacques Tourneur, who I love very much. And it's a really got some of the great sequences of sort of horror of the period that I think exist. I mean, I'm building it up too much, but one thing that's really neat about this disc is that they've ported over, and this is a connection to my first pick, they've ported over a commentary from Mr. William Friedkin himself.
Oh, wow.
He's a big fan of this movie, and he goes into great detail about structural things that the movie does, and how it, like, it's basically about a small village, I forget where, like, it feels like almost like Mexico or something, but I'm forgetting where it takes place, but basically there's like a nightclub, and this guy has two women, or I can't tell if he manages both or if he just is a friend's manager to one, and the women kind of are competing with each other. One of them is a woman, I think her name is Clo-Clo, and she has this castanet routine that she does, and she's very popular, and so the other girl's manager, boyfriend, whatever, is like, I got a gimmick for you. He's like, I got you this leopard, and you can just you can walk out with this leopard, and it'll be this great thing, you know, it'll totally steal the thunder of this other woman. And so she does, and she kind of, while the girl's doing her castanet act, and the woman is so annoyed that she like snaps her castanets at the leopard, and it runs away, and it gets away, and then it starts killing people in the town. And there's a great sequence with this young girl going to get some cornmeal and having to go under this bridge, and then, you know, there's a great jump scare, and, you know, there's a great death sequence where there's blood coming under a doorway and stuff like that. But there's some other deaths, and you start to question, it becomes sort of a mystery as to whether or not the killing is being done by the leopard or done by somebody who knows the leopard is loose and is using it as a cover to commit their own murders. Mm-hmm. So it's unclear what, you know, the deal is, but it's just really great black and white, stylish, moody kind of stuff. Definitely a complimentary feature to Cat People for sure. But yeah, I really like it. I just like the way it plays out. I like, you know, the sort of like simplicity of it ultimately. But the freaking commentary is great because he's talking about how the structure of it is like that we'll sort of follow different random characters, and then, you know, they'll suddenly become the main character of the story. And he talked about how that is, you know, very early in the sort of postmodern movement, and it, you know, is an influence on things like Pulp Fiction, and I was thinking of Slacker myself, but I don't know how right or wrong he is about that, but it definitely is interesting structurally for that time. He talks about it being an influence on Psycho,
oh, wow.
You know, and he goes pretty deep in his love for Lewton. It's a great commentary.
Lewton is definitely responsible for the classic horror film. And his films stand as tall as anyone's in that genre. Although he never really showed you anything horrible. All of that came later. That's something that we as filmmakers have lost. We now feel we have to show everything. Every plunge of the knife, every moment of pain and agony that the victims have to go through. That's what you see in horror films today. People cut up by hacksaws, people ripped apart at the hands of alien creatures. I think if Luton had shot any of those films, you would not have seen the ultimate murders, but you would have felt them much more, and they would have lived on in your dreams and nightmares for years to come, which is, of course, the objective of a maker of this kind of genre film.
There is also a second commentary track, which is cool. It is with one of the directors of the Val Luton, The Man in the Shadows documentary, which was part of the original DVD box set, but they re-released it, Scream Factory did, on their Body Snatcher Blu-ray, which I talked about recently. So you can go and watch that doc on that disc. But this guy, he's good, but it feels like an old Criterion Laserdisc commentary in that it's packed with info, it's a tiny bit stiff, you know, it's basically him reading an essay, but it's academic in a good way, and he gives this great overview of Luton at the top, and then he goes into very specific detail. So it's a different approach than Friedkin, and it's just really, the two complement each other really well, and it looks great. So that's yet another wonderful Val Luton release, and kudos to Scream. I can't wait for the Elric Kane favorite, The Seventh Victim, and I Walked with a Zombie. I hope those are in the works. We'll see. But another great one, The Leopard Man from Scream.
Very, very cool. And we'll keep the love in the Shout family. My next pick is a Shout Select title. This would be number 68 in that collection if you're paying attention to the numbers. But it's from 1993, California with a K.
I think we got a book here. A book on some of the most infamous murders in American history. I want to go to where they lived and where they killed, and I want you to take the pictures, and I'm going to write the text.
Looking for somebody to take turns at the wheel and share expenses on a week-long cross-country Blue Highways tour of historic murder sites? Brian, who in the right mind is going to want to do that?
Early, tell me more about California.
Let's see. One thing, people think faster out there on account of all that warm weather. Cold weather make people stupid. That's a fact.
I guess that'd explain why there's so many stupid people around here.
I think we should at least meet them first.
Beggars can't be choosers. They were the only ones to answer the rideshare note, remember?
Please don't let them be as boring as Brian's friends. Anything but that.
You've got to be kidding me. Look at them. They look like Okies.
Oh, jeez, Early. They look kind of weird.
He can't help the way he was raised.
Gotta feel sorry for him.
You feel sorry for him? That's so sweet. You cut your hair.
Early cut it. He said it makes me look more pretty.
You know, you and I, we gotta talk about your good buddy, Early.
Who said he's my good buddy?
You look good with a gun, Brian.
I'm giving that a shot, you mean boy.
A week ago, you would never have picked up that gun. Never!
They say it's a tourist job. That sound like your boy?
There is a nationwide manhunt for Early Gray.
What was that?
Nothing, Brian. It was just the thunder.
I saw him kill a man.
You ain't never killed no one, have you, bro?
No.
Tell me something, big time. How in the hell you gonna write a book about something you don't know nothing about?
He's a monster!
I had missed this movie. This is actually one of my blind spots from the early 90s. So this is 93. So this is kind of around, you know, right before that Pulp Fiction boom. But like,
yeah.
Things were getting kind of gritty and interesting in the world. And so this disc has both the unrated director's cut and it features the theatrical version for the first time on Blu-ray. So I'm guessing that the theatrical version has never been available. They probably released it on VHS and DVD as like, you know, unrated cut or whatever it is.
Yep.
So this has got both on there, which I always like that they make them both available. And I don't even know which one I watched. I think I watched the theatrical now that I think of it. But this is a cool movie. It's a very young David Duchovny who is basically a true crime writer. He's written, you know, he's had some success writing some articles about some serial killer cases, and he wants to kind of go on this road trip with his girlfriend, who's a photographer, to write a book based on visiting the sites of a former serial killer activity. And basically he brings her along as kind of, I don't want to say a romantic thing, but basically so she can work on it with him since she's a photographer, she can take the photos, etc. And kind of to save costs, they put an ad up for somebody to carpool with them, and they end up picking up Brad Pitt and Juliette Lewis, who were a real-life couple at the time. So there's that. But Brad Pitt turns out to be a serial killer. So the very thing he's documenting, he is literally in the car with somebody that is a serial killer. So it's very cool. I mean, very, you know, kind of gritty for the early 90s. Again, that I miss this time period for movies because they all kind of had this feel and aesthetic for it. And it's pretty interesting. It was directed by Dominic Senna, who is on this disc. I'll talk about that in a minute. But basically, he's one of these guys that came up on music videos and started a production company with David Fincher at this time to make movies like this. And so it was kind of like their production company was meant to help kind of get these guys music video jobs in between their films, basically to keep them all busy. So it's like it was like him, Fincher, I think Anton Fuqua, just a lot of interesting directors at that point that were doing music videos trying to break into the movies. So that was what was going on there. But what I love about this particular disc is, you know, sometimes you get an interview with whoever it is. It could be an editor or just an actor from the movie, and you just never know how it's going to go. This is a really engaging 24-minute interview with the director of the film, talking about the whole process, how it came together, how he met those guys like Fincher, the casting of it. It's really interesting that Brad Pitt at that point was at a crossroads in his career because he was basically on the verge of being kind of pigeonholed as just the pretty boy, and he really wanted to do weird and different stuff. And so this came along and he just chipped his tooth and he's like, I'm gonna leave the chip in my tooth so I look a little crazier. And he just got all method and like really got into this whole serial killer role. And it's interesting because it's 93, so he did this and True Romance back to back, Floyd the Stoner being one of my favorite characters of all time.
So great.
So he was really going for it in terms of I gotta do different stuff. So there was, you know, all these great casting stories, and just, you know, sometimes certain movies have an interesting, rich history, and I love hearing the stories about it. So since it's a road trip movie, they shot it kind of chronologically as a road trip movie. So they're going from they only got 1 or 2 days in each location that they're going to. So I kind of found that fascinating, and the director tells a great story about how they were doing the opening. There's a big car crash in the opening and they did it once and the stunt didn't look great, or he wanted something with a lot more damage to it. And basically his crew is like, well, that's the only car we have. Like, we only got one. And he's like, oh my God, we're screwed. Like, how did you only get one version of this car? And then literally by fate, it's like late at night, a car drives by on the highway and it is the exact same car that they just wrecked. So they're like, flag that guy down. And so they like flag this guy down and basically paid him to be like, we need your car for a movie and we're going to destroy it. And they somehow like talked him into it. I mean, they must have paid him a lot of money for it, I guess. Yeah. But it's just those little, I love those little synchronicity stories that are like, that's just too impossible to believe, but
yeah,
it did actually happen.
That's awesome.
So that's on here, and also a fairly short EPK from the original release. So it looks good. It's two versions of the movie. Great interview with the director. And if you're a fan of this movie from this time period, I think this is a great release of it. I even like the newly commissioned cover art, because I've always been used to the VHS box cover, which is the reverse. But they got this really beautiful drawing of the four principal cast members for the cover. Oh, and California was it's spelled with a K. And he tells just a funny story that when they went to copyright the movie, They basically told them they had to change the title because you can't copyright California because it's a state. It's, there's too many things called California. And so he's like, oh God, just whatever. Just change it to a K. So it has no other significance whatsoever other than that. It was a copyright issue.
That's so funny. It's weird because it actually kind of fits for some reason. And I couldn't tell you why. And I never questioned it, you know? That's great.
Yeah. It totally fits.
Good stuff. Yeah, a sort of forgotten movie these days. So very cool.
Yeah.
All right. Next up on my pile, continuing the classic horror, I have one from Kino. This is Dead of Night from 1945.
Ooh. But it doesn't end there. You see, everybody in this room is part of my dream. Everybody.
Gosh.
Good Lord, really?
Very extraordinary.
You're kidding.
What, all of us?
I can only tell you that when I came into this room, I recognized you all instantly.
Having seen all our photographs in the newspapers, I take it, Dr. Van Straten.
Of course, you may have seen me on the sports page. Motor racing's my line.
And there was one of me once in the Kentish Mercury when I was a bridesmaid at my sister's wedding. You remember? Oh, but I shouldn't think you'd come across that.
Well, I've never had a photograph taken.
Oh, yes, you did, dear, once. Do you know the one? Naked on a white fur rug. You were 6 months old.
Good Lord, that's right. I don't think you'd recognize me. I was much fatter.
Surely, Mr. Craig, you might have seen any of us sometime or another, in the street or anywhere.
Yes, but why should I always dream about meeting you all together, here in this room, that I've never been in my life until today?
Mr. Craig, can you describe what happens in your dream?
Well, not in detail, but it always starts exactly the same as when I arrived just now. I turn off the main road into the lane. At the bend in the lane, the house comes into view, and I stop as I recognize it. Then I drive on again. And Foley meets me at the front door. I recognize him, too. And then, while I'm taking off my coat, I have the most extraordinary feeling. I nearly turn and run for it. Because I know I'm going to come face to face with the six of them.
Are you familiar with this one?
Oh, yeah, yeah. I've been waiting for this Blu-ray.
It's great, dude. You're not going to be disappointed. I mean, it looks fantastic. It's a 4K restoration. For those who don't know, this is one of the earliest horror anthologies that exists. There may be a few others prior, but this is the one that a lot of folks point to as ground zero for horror anthology stuff. It's a British movie. It's, you know, from the Ealing Studios, and they were more known for their comedies at the time. They did a bunch with Alec Guinness, you know, The Man in the White Suit and stuff like that. And this plays more like a low-key Twilight Zone movie, but, you know, before Twilight Zone ever existed. And I wouldn't be surprised if Rod Serling saw it and maybe gleaned a thing or two from it, because it's pretty great in terms of the overall story is basically about this guy. He's an architect. He's called to this remote house in the country for the weekend. And as he's pulling up, he's kind of like, what? You know, you're getting a sense that there's something strange going on. The guy brings him in the house, and right away he knows like where to put his coat. And then it comes out that he has been in this house before in his dreams, and he's very uncomfortable about it because, as you find out, like in the dream, things start to go kind of bad, and he starts to predict things. And so he's meeting this group of strangers, and that wraparound story is I think what really holds this thing together, because you're like, what's going on with this guy and his deja vu? Like, is that real? What's that about? And then of course they kind of organically get into it with each of the characters who has like some kind of supernatural story that they tell. And it's really well done, I think, for what it is. And it's got like, you know, uneasy, you know, there's like a Final Destination type story. There's a, you know, ghost story. There's a haunted mirror. There's, you know, it's most famous for a ventriloquist dummy sequence, which is definitely the best sequence in the movie for sure. And still really holds up. It's definitely one of the early examples of the, you know, killer doll. I think there's a movie called Devil Doll from 1936 that preceded it, but it's pretty great. It's, you know, it's not, you know, magic is fun and everything, but I really like this one.
Yeah.
It's not exactly Val Lewton in its vibe, but it's definitely for a film for fans of Lewton, and like say Curse of the Demon, I think would be a nice double with this one. I'm a big fan of that.
Yeah.
But like I said, it looks great. And then it's got two excellent special features. The first is ported over from a previous release, a British release that I had, and that is this wonderful documentary, about 75 minutes, called Remembering Dead of Night. And that features John Landis and Kim Newman, who I love, and he's going to come up again in a minute. He's also featured on another disc that I talk about. So there's clips of those guys talking and a whole bunch of other British critics, and it's really wonderful to hear this overview of them talking about the movie and how sort of remarkable it was at the time and how it must have really thrown people off, because you have a structure where you've got a people in a room and they keep going into these flashback stories, and then you're wondering like what's going on with the, you know, the main guy who showed up the house. And so they were just talking about the influence of the movie and what things work and don't work, and it's really well done.
Dead of Night hit on the anthology format, which had been used a little in Hollywood. There's a movie called Flesh and Fantasy, and there are a bunch of German films with titles like Uncanny Tales that did that thing of taking a couple of Edgar Allan Poe stories and maybe a Robert Louis Stevenson story and a new made horror story and doing five glued together. And some of there's a silent German film called Waxworks, which has a frame story. The individual episodes are based on the tableau in a scary waxwork, and then at the end, one of the waxworks comes to life and pursues the character who's been around. So the format of Dead of Night kind of existed before Dead of Night did it, but Dead of Night essentially perfected the anthology horror story. Almost all subsequent anthology horror movies are modeled on Dead of Night.
This is a very important film in the history of horror. So from Dead of Night springs all kinds of things, like the Amicus portmanteau films of the 60s and 70s, Asylum, Dr. Terror's House of Horrors, that idea that became in a way a bit of a joke by the time that it had paid itself out, that you would go to see a film that had in a way some of the pleasures of television and the pleasures of the short story rather than the big epic, this idea of a film broken down into episodes. And in a way it became a fairly standard model. But here is where it begins, really, or here is where it begins in earnest, because this is such a successful film. Its influence has been very profound, I think. It is the one that you can trace all of those later examples back to.
And then on top of that, they've got a new audio commentary by Tim Lucas, who I've talked about ad nauseum on the show, but there's a reason for that, and that is he's fantastic. And I cannot get enough of Tim Lucas commentaries. I would take Tim Lucas commentaries on every disc ever if it was possible. But he talks about so much stuff, including the structural stuff, and you know, he just goes into his usual detail. I'm not trying to, you know, gloss over it, but like, it's always great. Like, he always has great little tidbits about certain actors or the production or the context. He is just one of my favorite audio commentators. So that is a delightful track, and this is a must own for classic horror fans, I think.
Yeah, I can't wait for this one myself.
Nice.
A couple years ago for October, I did a 31 anthologies of Halloween, which is pretty crazy. So this was in the mix, and I was delirious at that point because it's like watching 150 films. But it was only available. It was a pretty not so good version on Amazon Prime. So I was pretty stoked when I saw that Kino was going to do a DVD, a Blu-ray of this. I'm sorry. So yeah, I got to pick this one up.
Definitely must have. Yeah. Good stuff. From, like you say, Kino, Dead of Night.
Cool. My next pick is a film I saw years ago, and I picked up this disc a while back. I finally just had a hankering to watch it. It's kind of a long lost classic. It's the 50th anniversary edition of Peeping Tom.
Look out! Look out! Look out! Take care. You are being watched. We repeat, take care, for you are now alone with a killer. We warn you, don't let him see the fear in your eyes. For this is what he seeks, and this is why he kills.
Where are you? Where are you?
Look. out for Carl Byrne as the Peeping Tom. Fear him, but pity him also.
It's so good.
Watch out for Moira Shearer as the lovely stand-in who innocently dances into danger.
Imagine. Someone coming towards you. Who wants to kill you. Regardless of consequences.
A madman?
Yes.
Wait! Look!
Oh, cool.
Yeah, this is a Region B UK release only. That was done a couple years ago from, I guess it's Studio Canal with Optimum Classic.
Optimum, yeah.
And I'm really shocked that there's no US equivalent of this, because this is a brand new 4K scan from the original negative, I believe. It's got an audio commentary with Ian Christie. It's got several little featurettes that look like they were probably quartered over from a different DVD release. But in case you're curious what this was Michael Powell's film in 19... It came out... it's 1959, 1960, but this is right before Psycho. And this basically ruined his career. It's one of the first truly voyeuristic movies that puts us in the shoes of a psycho. And it's basically this character played by Carl Boehm, Mark Lewis, who is he's a focus puller at a film studio, but he's also obsessed with photography and film and all that. And he's got all these films that he watches of his childhood, which are disturbing in itself. and basically the girl that lives downstairs develops a little bit of a, I wouldn't say a crush, but just a curiosity about this good-looking, strange, quiet to himself young man that lives upstairs. And I don't know. I guess it was just one of those types of movies that really rubbed people the wrong way when it came out. Nobody had seen anything quite like it, and called it, there were protests. There's a quote here from the Spectator that says it's the sickest and filthiest film I can remember seeing, while the Tribune wanted it flushed swiftly down the nearest sewer. Which is insane. Because it's a very beautifully made film. This restoration of it, by the way, is just, the colors pop so much. It's a really beautiful looking movie. And the unsung hero of this movie, who gives an introduction on the disc, is Marty Scorsese. Cause he apparently, somebody had put it on his radar way, way back. And I didn't realize this. He is solely responsible for this release.
Nice.
Not necessarily this 50th anniversary release, I'm sure, in effect, but he's the reason that Peeping Tom got a re-release. It was a film he heard about, and somebody had helped him track down a print, and he finally watched it because he was a big fan of Powell's and didn't understand. And he saw the film as a masterpiece, and he's like, we got to get this out to the public again. So he talks a little bit about it in his introduction.
Peeping Tom is a frightening experience. It's also a thrilling one because it gets close, very close to the heart of the impulse deep within filmmaking. I mean, to make films, to make images and stories from those images, other imagined worlds, really, it's exciting and intoxicating, which means that can get a grip on you, and unless you're very careful, it won't let you go. To capture someone's image on camera is a very powerful act. We've forgotten that now, since we're so overrun with images here in the Western world. There's a reason why taking someone's photograph is still forbidden in some cultures. The belief is that you're stealing a piece of their soul, and to a certain extent, and I can understand this, when someone agrees to appear on camera, whether it's in a fiction film or a documentary, we shouldn't forget that they're giving something very special of themselves. This is what Michael Powell captured in Peeping Tom. Powell dared what no one else had dared before him, to show us how close movie making could come to madness, how it could eat you up. He was telling an extremely uncomfortable truth, something that nobody really wanted to know, on top of which he was doing it in a spectacular lurid Eastman color, images that almost recall the covers of porno magazines. And he paid the price. I mean, Peeping Tom put an end to his career in England, and he had to go to Australia in order to find what little work he could later on. When I saw Peeping Tom, my first reaction was, could this have been the same man who made The Red Shoes, made this picture? could that be? But then, of course, I realized that there was a very strong link between the two pictures, just as there's a sort of vital continuity running throughout all of Michael's pictures, with and without Emmerich Pressburger. Michael was always showing us how necessary art is and how far it can drive you in your passions. And he was also showing that it could consume you if you weren't careful. In a sense, Peeping Tom was his last word on the matter. It's also one of his greatest films.
Yeah, I mean, all hail Marty Scorsese for saving this from obscurity. It's basically the pre-Psycho Psycho. Nice. So, yeah, and again, I don't know why I don't know why there's not a U.S. release of it yet, especially since this 4K scan exists. It seems ideal for like a Criterion sort of deal, but as of right now, this is the only version that exists, and it is region B only. So you will definitely need a region free player to play it.
Yeah, it's crazy to me because that was one of the early Criterion DVDs, one of the first DVDs they put out, and yeah, I have this same Blu-ray and it's fantastic, and it does shock me that it hasn't gotten an upgrade yet. I don't understand. I mean, if it's Studio Canal, that could be part of the problem. I know that, you know, Criterion and them had some static maybe or something where they lost, you know, The Third Man and a couple other movies to Studio Canal, and I don't know what couldn't be worked out, but it's unfortunate because we need this movie out in the States. And I do love that Scorsese is a big fan of Powell and Pressburger, and it's because of him that I even know who they are, you know.
Yeah.
I mean, The Life and Death of Curl Blimp and you know, Black Narcissus and I Know Where I'm Going. I mean, these are really, really great movies. Red Shoes, that's a huge Scorsese favorite right there. I just got Tales of Hoffman, which is another Powell Pressburger. It's also an import, not available in the States, and also has a Criterion DVD with Scorsese all over it. So I don't know what's up with these. I don't know. It may be just some sort of British rights, you know, Studio Canal hang-up.
Yeah.
But yeah, definitely recommended as a pickup. It's a classic. I mean, it's like you say, it's up there with Psycho as one of those movies that should be heralded as much as that movie is, I think.
Yeah, so. I mean, it's no Psycho to me, but
no, it's not
pretty darn good.
Yeah, that's what I mean. Yeah,
and great. Look, if you're listening to this, you're inevitably probably a region free person. Brian and I both own this, so you should add it to your collection. Plain
absolutely
and simple, awesome. Amazon UK, do the
it
trick.
Do it.
Keeping time.
good stuff. All right, so I'm going to go British myself. Again, I didn't even realize I had two British in a row, but this is one of my favorite science fiction movies. I've talked about it on Pure Cinema once or twice, I think. It is Quatermass in the Pit from 1967 or 68? 67.
Who were they running from? What have they seen? Whom do they fear? There are 5 million answers to these questions, and every one of them is a shocker.
No, I saw it. Horrible.
Terror, 5 million years old, spills into our time to make two worlds collide. What is happening here and now can affect the next 5 million years.
It was what I was afraid of. The thing got a huge intake of energy. The very substance of it seemed to be coming alive. And you can't see this world any longer.
They feel it. They see it. The archaeologist who digs back into the past to unearth more horror than the human mind can bear. Quatermass, the scientist, who comes face to face with 5 million years of terror.
Rooney, it's Barbara. She's the one. Get down here, quick.
She can see into the pit and knows the terrifying truth.
Oh, man.
He can see into the pit, but he will not believe what he sees.
They were coming.
Who? What were?
Them. Them.
You saw the creatures.
They were alive.
And this one It's from Scream Factory, and this is a really stacked, great release. You know, this is part of a group of Hammer films that they've been cranking out, and there's some really good stuff already released, and there's more good stuff coming. The Devil Rides Out, for instance, which I just freaking bought an import of, is coming from them. That's one of my favorites along with this, in terms of Hammer. But this is set in, I believe, it's set in London, and basically the premise is that a construction crew is digging, they're digging out a subway tunnel, I think, and they end up coming across a ship, and it's unclear what the deal is, but it's potentially a Martian ship, and the military gets involved, and, you know, there's a scientist, Quatermass is one of the scientists, and there's that classic military scientist conflict, kind of like, say, Raiders of the Lost Ark. You know, I could definitely see this being an influence on Spielberg in terms of the way the military wants to approach this discovery versus how the scientist wants to approach it. And so it becomes a thing that gets more sort of grandiose and complex in terms of the implications of this discovery. And I won't go into the details about it, but it does have like ramifications for mankind as a whole and our civilization and some things that we've sort of come up with over the years that, you know, could sort of originate from this thing, this discovery. And it's got some great, like, uneasy, creepy moments to it, you know, and it's, like I said, sort of high-minded with its ideas, but it really, I think, delivers. I mean, most British horror and science fiction are a little talky, so I think that's something you have to get used to, and this movie is no exception, but I think there's enough great atmospheric moments with it that it really plays well, at least for me, and I've seen it at least four or five times now, and every time I, you know, dig it even more. So this disc is ridiculous. It has... I had an old, might have been Optimum Blu-ray, and this ports over some of the features for that. There is a whole bunch of interviews that were part of that disc, including interviews with Mr. Joe Dante.
Ooh.
5 Minutes to Earth, or Quatermass in the Pit, is, I think, one of the great science fiction pictures of the 60s, and certainly, if you haven't seen it, it's a gap in your knowledge that has to be filled.
And then Kim Newman, again, who I love. Like, Kim Newman to me and Joe Dante, like, you really, between those two guys, like, you know, they're just incredible. Like, the way that they can talk about movies is, you know, unparalleled. And I love hearing them get into it about stuff that they love. And so it's got, I want to just differentiate between the new stuff and the old stuff. So the interviews, there's one of the actors, like an author named Judith Kerr, an actor from the movie, Julian Glover. There's an actor-writer, Mark Gatiss, Joe Dante, Kim Newman, film historian Marcus Hearn. There's an audio commentary with director Roy Ward Baker and writer Nigel Neal. And these guys were really big in terms of Hammer. They did a lot of interesting stuff. And, of course, are no longer with us. I don't think either of them. Maybe one is, but I don't think so. That track is a little sparse. It's basically two old British dudes, you know, sitting there. So they don't, there are long gaps where they're just watching and not saying anything, which is whatever. It's still nice to have them. But then in terms of the new features, there's a new audio commentary with film historian Bruce G. Hallenbeck, which is good. There's another new audio commentary with filmmaker Konstantin Nazir and author film historian Steve Haberman. Also good. Haberman is like a regular on, you know, classic horror and sci-fi commentaries, and he's solid. Mm-hmm. New interview with actor Hugh Futcher, new interview with Academy Award-winning special effects artist Brian Johnson, who worked on Alien, new interview with clapper loader Trevor Koop, and focus puller Bob Jordan. So I think these guys are both on the movie. I didn't get a chance to watch those interviews, but it's a ton of stuff. It's like a metric ton of shit. And for a movie that I love, like, I couldn't be happier. You know, this is just the ultimate release of this Criterion level stuff. They also put out Quatermass 2, which is good and precedes Quatermass in the Pit. and it's a different guy playing Quatermass. Brian Dunleavy plays Quatermass in that. Also a good movie. But Quatermass in the Pit is the shit for me. And like I said, one of my favorites. Kim Newman has a really great bit where he talks about comparing it to 2001 and how he says that it expresses its ideas better than 2001, but the ideas are in a similar vein.
What then happened is Arthur C. Clarke took those ideas and worked them up with Stanley Kubrick into 2001, a film that came out a year after Quatermass and the Pit. And they make a really interesting back-to-back viewing, because it's almost like 2001 is hugely ambitious in a physical sense that Quatermass and the Pit isn't. But it's almost like Quatermass and the Pit articulates its ideas a bit better. People came out of 2001 scratching their heads a bit as to what actually was going on. But it's the same notion that you have in Quatermass and the Pit of ancient astronauts have tampered with man's evolution, not entirely for the better, that they have added the kind of the kill response, the aggressiveness of human nature, which has enabled civilization, but has also led to all kinds of terrible, terrible things.
And I think that's a comparison that's really apt and interesting. And I think I'm inclined to agree. As much as I love 2001, I think 2001 and Quatermass in the Pit would be a very intriguing double feature for sure. So definitely think of it like that, that kind of sci-fi, you know? So anyway, it's good stuff. Scream Factory, part of their Hammer line, Quatermass and the Pit.
Very cool. Yeah, Hammer's still a blind spot, and those movies in particular. And I know Carpenter, John Carpenter, is a huge fan and got the writer of that to do Halloween 3, was it?
I think so, yeah. Nigel Neal,
Yeah, very cool. So my final pick is technically a double feature. So it'll be my final pick and my runner-up. And I started with Criterion. I'm closing with Criterion. It is the great Jackie Chan in Police Story and Police Story 2.
Kick ass.
It's the end of the line. You're coming back with me.
Get rid of Detective Sergeant Jackie Chan.
Yeah, I am all in on Jackie Chan again. I mean, I've always been a fan. I remember going to see Rumble in the Bronx in theaters. That was a big deal when that movie was coming out. I'd been vaguely familiar with him up until then, but Rumble in the Bronx was like his big U.S. movie. And then from there was just like a whole spat of them. I think they were coming out through Miramax, but Super Cop, which is technically Police Story 3. But Super Cop, Mr. Nice Guy was one I remember loving a lot. And then, of course, it all kind of paved the way for the Rush Hour series, which was, I guess, his biggest hits here in the States. But, you know, I'd only been vaguely familiar with the earlier films, and I'd seen them here and there. I had never seen Police Story. And so I'd seen scenes from it. I totally recognized, as I was watching it, certain set pieces that I was like, oh, this is the movie it's from. But basically Criterion did an incredible job with both these movies, but the first one is kind of the quintessential, Jackie Chan movie, because he had come to the States. He had tried to break into the business. He'd done maybe the Cannonball Run movies, but didn't really succeed. And so Police Story was his movie that he went back home to make, with his stunt crew, and it was kind of his, I got something to prove because I didn't break America. And I mean, man, does he go for it. It's a pretty traditional police story. He's kind of I don't want to say a rookie, but a fairly, by the book kind of police officer. And like a raid kind of goes wrong in the beginning. It's this incredible sequence where there's these cars going through a village on a hill, which, you know, you look at it and you're like, how are these people not dying. yeah, because they're trying to bust like these corrupt businessmen, and they get on a bus. And so the key image, which is on, when you pull the Criterion out, there's drawings from each movie, and the key image for part one is him hanging off the side of a bus with an umbrella, which is a big part of that sequence. And anyways, he kind of just keeps getting in trouble. But now that he's kind of pointed the finger at these higher up rich, corrupt folk, they are after him and his girlfriend. So basically it's just the thing about Jackie Chan, it's like, this is what I miss about movies, especially action movies. Like, I can enjoy a Jason Statham movie for its ridiculousness and Fast and Furious and all that stuff. I sort of get it. But these, like, Jackie Chan and his team are really doing everything. And there's a sense of awe when you see people really punching each other and breaking glass and taking these giant falls and whatever else it is. And the great thing about it, every one of his movies, you get to see the outtakes and the ones that went wrong during the end credits. That's always the fun of it, is you get to the end credits, you get to see where not everything worked out, and it hurt like hell. But I gotta tell you, the last 20, 25 minutes of this movie, which basically takes place, it's just all action in a shopping mall, has gotta be some of the greatest action ever put to film. It is just jaw-dropping, incredible, exciting, so much fun to watch. And I was so excited that the second one was in this collection, because I immediately went and watched the sequel right away, which pretty much just picks up exactly where the last one left off. Criterion really just outdid themselves with this disc, man. On top of the movies looking amazing, which they do, there's so many features between both discs. I have yet to get through all of them, but the few things I did get to were pretty special. So on the first disc for Police Story 1, there's a double Edgar Wright feature. One is an interview with Edgar Wright about his love of Jackie Chan and discovering it. And then there's a second piece, which is an audio interview. Basically, he was asked to interview Jackie on a podcast. And so that podcast is available in its entirety as an audio interview. So you got Edgar Wright on the disc. There's a feature called Becoming Jackie with Grady Hendrix, who is an author. He's a well-known, primarily horror author, who did We Sold Our Souls and Horror Story, the one that takes place in the IKEA, and most famously My Best Friend's Exorcism. But he's also, I forget his title, but he's got his hand in like the Asian film festivals that kind of kicked off in New York, and just basically a total aficionado for Asian cinema. So he's an expert. He gives a whole interview/essay about Jackie Chan and his history. But my favorite thing on here, and I saw it on, I think it was on Facebook or YouTube. It was a video that was floating around. There's a segment called The King versus Kings 2, and it's a 2017 television special, which basically was honoring Jackie Chan and 40 years of his stunt company. Because at this point, there have now been two generations of stuntmen that have all served with Jackie Chan. And crazy. So he's on stage watching this tribute video they put together with him. And these are like dudes that risked their lives back when they were all in their 20s. And now they're like in their 60s or whatever. And it's beautiful. As he's watching this video and starting to tear up, they're saying, oh, we haven't seen him in 20, 30, 40 years almost. They're all lining up behind him. Like, they're all physically there. And when the video ends, he turns around, and I defy you to not start crying at this moment of him being reunited with the people that he started his stunt company with. And then he sings the song from Police Story, because he does actually sing the theme song in the end credits. So he performs it live in this segment. So that alone is incredible stuff. And that's only on the first disc. I've barely touched disc 2. God. Yeah, I mean, the features on this thing are just, they just went above and beyond. And if you've never gotten into Jackie Chan, I think this is the perfect starting point. I think you got to start with Criterion's Police Story and Police Story 2. Between the two movies and all the features on here, I think you're going to get it. You're going to like get it and fall in love with this guy and everything he's done and accomplished and realize there is nobody like him in movies today that's doing any of this. We've totally lost it. And this put me on a giant rabbit hole because I tweeted about this and my buddy Dan Budnick replied and asked, hey, did you get the Eureka release of Project A and Project A Part 2, which is a Region B release? And I'm like, no, but I'm going to order it right now.
Damn it. I need to order that.
I did. I just got it in the mail like 2 days ago. So that might be next month's pick.
I also need to have Dan Budnick on the show, by the way.
You absolutely do. He's excellent, excellent movie cinephile. Everybody listening to this should be following Dan Budnick. So
yeah. Danny Slacks. on Twitter. Yeah, he's great. I've heard him on Shockwaves or Killer POV. I can't remember which.
Both.
Yeah. Oh, is he on both? Great. Yeah. He's a gem, that guy. Good stuff.
Yeah, and a big Jackie Chan enthusiast. And you got to get Police Story if you don't already have it. But yeah, you should probably get that Project A as well.
Well, this is a case, of course, where like last episode, I bought this and I put on the first one just to check it out, but I haven't had a chance to go back to it, so I didn't touch the extras. I didn't touch Part 2, but I'm a big Jackie Chan fan myself.
Have you seen this movie, though, like even back in the day?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, man. Yeah, I mean, it's amazing.
There's one stunt at the ending that he had 12 cameras rolling on it, and it's so good that they show it like 5 times in a row.
It's definitely one of his best movies. Yeah. I mean, maybe my favorite. I don't know. I'm not sure. But another guy I follow on Twitter is Marcus Pinn. He's Pinland Empire, P-I-N-N-L-A-N-D Empire. And he does a great thing, which are his side-by-sides, where he takes GIFs and he'll put them, you know, 2 or 3 GIFs in a row side-by-side from different movies. And this will be old news when this comes out, but lately he's been running GIFs of Jackie Chan movies and Buster Keaton movies side by side. And you can see some great stuff. I mean, Jackie Chan has totally acknowledged Buster Keaton as an influence, but you can definitely see some stuff where you're like, oh, wow, he probably stole that from Buster and is doing his own thing with it, but it looks very similar in the greatest way. And so I was just, you know, getting a high off of seeing two cinema greats, you know, right next to each other. I just love the juxtaposition of it. So I can't wait to get that project. I'm going to have to get that ASAP.
Yeah. Sorry.
No, it's all good. It's all good. I need more Jackie Chan in my life. All right. Well, so those were your last two?
Yeah.
In one? Okay. I'll buzz through my last and my bonus really quick here.
Sure.
So a company that I haven't talked about enough on the show is Umbrella Entertainment.
Oh, yeah.
They are from Australia, and they are great. Especially for Australian films. Road Games comes to mind as one of the great, you know, probably their best release, and a fantastic movie from Richard Franklin that has a killer release from them. But, you know, they did Frog Dreaming, which is a Brian Trenchard-Smith movie, and they did Silver Bullet, which I think is the best Blu-ray available right now.
Oh, yeah.
And Beastmaster and some others. They are great. Most of their stuff is all region. This particular disc is region locked, and I'm talking about Krull from 1983.
Ooh. On a distant planet, a great kingdom was ravaged by beings who came from the future to conquer the universe.
Bowen!
Now, the only survivors follow a doubtful seer and a throneless king.
They will hold her in the Black Fortress. You must have help.
Thieves, bandits, fighters and brawlers.
Desperate men. Those are the kind of men I need.
Well, you heard him. We are now an army.
At the end of an impossible journey, they must fight an invincible enemy.
Here's the knowledge you seek.
I shall be your king.
In the fortress, you will face more than the slayers.
What is about to happen to them could never have happened on Earth. Columbia Pictures presents A World Apart from Anything You Have Seen Before. Crawl.
So this one, I didn't do an A to B comparison of it, but there is a, I want to say, Mill Creek Entertainment Bare Bones Blu-ray.
Yes, that's the one I have.
And it may be the same transfer, but now what this does is it ports over all the special features from the DVD. So you could do one of two things. You could buy the Mill Creek and then just have the special edition DVD for the extras. I like to have them all in one place personally. So that's part of the reason I was excited to get this. So this movie, Elric and I are both big fans of it. Obviously you are too. It's just one of those movies where, you know, '80s All Over really took a dump on it when they talked about it, and it bummed us out in a big way, to the point where we had been talking about doing a fantasy episode more or less so we could come out and counter their unfortunate negativity about the movie at the time. And I get it. You know, some people, it's not their bag, right? But I don't know. For me, I just think it's such a unique combination of, you know, like a Star Wars and J.R.R. Tolkien kind of universe. There's like Adventures of Robin Hood kind of going on, swashbucklery stuff. So it's like swords and sorcery and lasers, you know, I mean, for people that don't know, the swords even like spark red electricity when they hit each other. So there's very much like a vibe of like somebody going, we need more Star Wars. So let's do that. But obviously I love the idea of the story, which is basically that two kingdoms are coming together at the beginning of the movie, and the prince and princess of the two kingdoms are getting married, and the wedding gets broken up, and the princess is captured by this evil being, and so the prince slash king has to go and save her. It's a very simple, straight up adventure story, but they have to, you know, as a classic quest, they have to kind of get a couple things before they go. One of those is the most famous weapon from the movie, which is the glaive, which is a spinning boomerangy knife thing, which is awesome and is well used in the movie. I love the weapons in general in the movie. The one thing I noticed this time was that there was some battle axe similarities between the character, not Liam Neeson, but his buddy has a battle axe. You know, they're these bandits, and the battle axe that his buddy has is somewhat similar to the battle axe that Nicolas Cage wields in Mandy. Ooh. And I even posted a picture of them on Twitter. It's not identical by any means. And I'm not saying that Panos Cosmatos is a big Kroll fan, but I wouldn't be surprised if he is. And it seems like it could be a thing where maybe the two movies, and that just makes me love Mandy even more, you know, just the idea that a Kroll battle axe maybe made its way.
I totally believe that connection.
Right? Doesn't that make sense?
Yeah.
So that, I'm sure tons of people have spotted that before me, but for whatever reason, I hadn't watched Kroll since I'd seen Mandy. And so this time I was like, ooh, battle axe. I love it. And then I told my wife and she was like, aren't all battle axes the same? I'm like, no, honey, you don't get this. This is a very, you know, epic battle axe, especially Cage's battle axe in Mandy is just so amazing.
Yeah.
So anyway, Kroll is a classic of sorts of the fantasy genre, and I do miss the fantasy genre of the 80s. One day we'll have a fantasy episode of Pure Cinema as soon as I can get Elric excited about it one more time. But
you have to convince Elric that this movie is not in 3D, as he remembers. He is convinced that he saw it in 3D in theaters, and I told him no, Kroll was never
insane.
In 3D.
Yeah. He's insane. I think he's thinking of Space Hunter or something. I don't know what he's thinking
yeah.
of.
Yeah, yeah.
But yeah, no. Which is too bad. I'd love to see this in 3D, but yeah, not the case. So the extras, as I mentioned, that are ported over are a cast and crew commentary that includes director Peter Yates, who did things like Bullet and The Friends of Eddie Coyle.
Wow.
And he's a fascinating director.
When Krell came up, I thought, well, this is a marvelous opportunity of really getting to know something about what is possible on film nowadays. I must say, I was amazed by what you can put on the fact that nothing limits you except your imagination. I've always tried to vary the kind of films that I've made, and although I started with Bullet, I didn't want to get tied down to purely doing car chases, otherwise no self-respecting actor would speak to me.
The commentary also includes the prince character, or the king character, Ken Marshall, and the princess, Lizette Antony, who is gorgeous, by the way. She's one of my favorite fantasy princess characters because she just has this almost like elf-like beauty, but it's not quite that. It's just this really, she's just gorgeous in this way that I don't know, not of this universe for me. I'm just so into her. So those guys are on the commentary. Then there's the behind the scenes commentary, which features a guy sort of reading a preview article from a Cine Fantastique magazine from right around the time the film came out, which is really cool. I like that track. And then there's something called Journey to Krull, which is 23 minutes, and it's a promotional piece from the time. Interestingly, narrated by Tom Bosley, who, if you don't know, was the dad on Happy Days, and he did the Glad commercials from the 80s. He has very specific voice. When you hear his voice, you'll be like, oh, it's the Glad guy, or it's, you know, Mr. C from Happy Days, which I just thought was interesting, because I don't think he's in the movie in any way, and I guess he was available. So,
making a movie like Krull is an enormous job. 10 sound stages at the Pinewood Studios in England are being used all at once, including the 007 stage where all the James Bond films were made. The largest stage in the world.
Action! Lasers!
One of the biggest problems in making a fantasy adventure is that the special effects demand so much attention.
Cut!
That the characters and their stories have sometimes been neglected, when in fact, what people really care about are people.
The Cyclops coming in looked very good.
If anything pleases me about this film, I think it is that the characters are people, that they act like people. We are on another planet. Things are going to look different from the way they do on Earth. But the emotions and the motivations and the goals of the people who live on Krull are not different from the people that you and I know.
Anyway, that is Krull, Region B locked, but well worth a pickup, as is Umbrella Entertainment's catalog, worth exploring. Very good stuff. They also did a release of No Escape. It's called Escape from Absalon in their release, but it's a really great Blu-ray of that, and that's not available anywhere else, and I love that movie. The last movie I have is just a quick bonus. This is from Warner Archive. It is my fun pick, if you will, and it is Corvette Summer from 1978.
Ooh. It's the car of a lifetime. It took him all year to build it.
Hell, I'm going to drive that thing right up to General Motors' front door.
One night to lose it.
Hey, that's my car! You stole my car!
And a whole summer to get it back. MGM presents Corvette Summer.
Somebody stole my Stingray. The word's out, it's in Vegas.
You've got a Corvette?
Starring Mark Hamill, who's back from Star Wars.
Oh, yeah!
And Annie Potts, who's out of this world.
You're gonna spend the night. Comprende, amigo?
If he knew as much about girls as he does about cars, he wouldn't be so nervous.
Peel off them duds, sailor, and let me see what you got.
Sure.
And if she knew as much about cars as she does about boys,
what do you drink?
She wouldn't be so jealous.
Motor oil?
And if you knew as much as they know about this candy apple metal flake Corvette, you'd be chasing it too.
I'm helping you, dope. I'm helping you find your car.
You run up against a car thief, be liable to wind up at the bottom of Lake Mead.
He's into fast cars.
Why don't you write a letter to the car? Dear car.
She's into black velvet.
Beg your pardon?
I believe. Wow!
Together, they find love.
You have no right to take me anywhere!
Excitement. And danger. On the trail of a stolen Corvette.
Stop this car! Stop it! I'm getting out!
Oh, no, you're not!
Mark Hamill, Annie Potts. It's the girl. The car and the time that separates the men from the boys. Corvette Summer.
It's a terrific car.
A fiberglass romance.
So this movie, kind of a goofy joke of a movie that is most famously the movie that came out with Mark Hamill after Star Wars.
Right.
I don't know if he filmed it before that movie or not, but he is pretty... I know I praised him highly in Sarah T. Portrait of a Teenage Alcoholic. This is definitely a different kind of character for him. Much bigger, much broader, over the top, dorky. Basically, he plays a high school senior who's like really into auto shop. And the opening scene is his whole class going to the junkyard to try and find a car, you know, that they can fix up. And it's this great bit of like everybody looking around for a car. And then he notices that the giant like claw that is picking up cars and dropping them into the car crusher has actually got like a really choice kind of beat up Corvette. And he like, you know, just starts flipping out and gets them to stop, you know, crushing the Corvette, and they take it back to the auto shop and the whole team fixes it up, and it's kind of Mark Hamill's baby and whatever. And so they clean up this car and it's gorgeous. It's this wonderful Corvette. And then they take it out for a spin on the town. I think I don't know if they're on Van Nuys Boulevard or where they are, but I think it's LA. And, I think it's Danny Bonaducci is one of the guys in his class, and I think it's Danny that like gets the car stolen. Like he leaves the car to go get like a Slurpee or something, and he leaves the keys in it, and somebody steals the car. So it's very like a proto Pee-wee's Big Adventure at that point, because Mark Hamill like loses his shit on Danny Bonaducci and is like, I can't believe you lost the car. This is insane. And so he is totally depressed, but he gets word that maybe it's at a casino in Las Vegas that somebody has sold it to this casino as a prize. So he goes to Las Vegas. He hitchhikes to Las Vegas, and he comes upon this woman played by Annie Potts from Ghostbusters and Designing Women that is driving this van. She's got a waterbed in the back, and she's trying to be a prostitute. And so she's driving to Las Vegas in her van to try and get her, you know, business started. And so she and Mark Hamill they kind of hit it off, but they kind of hate each other, and she's going to help him, and you know, it's sort of their adventures. And then of course they get split up, and will they get back together and whatever, and will he find the car, and that's sort of the whole thing. But it's really funny to watch Mark Hamill play this role. It may be too much for some people, but I don't know. It stars Wendy Jo Sperber, who is one of Marty McFly's. She's his sister in Back to the Future. She was in I Want to Hold Your Hand. She was a big favorite.
Big Zemeckis.
Big Zemeckis gal. She's great. The late Wendy Jo. I love her. So she's a small part of it. T.K. Carter has a nice scene with Brian James. If you know Brian James, he's a classic cult actor. And then there's a guy named Kim Mulford, who is one of the bad guys in the movie, and he played the lead in Laser Blast the same year. If you know Laser Blast, that's another crazy movie. But so there's an interesting smattering of a cast, and it looks gorgeous. This is, like I said, it's a Warner Archive Blu-ray. They always do a good job, and it's a very colorful 70s movie. Even the credits are like, I wish I could just, you'd know what I was talking about if I showed you like one of the stickers from the 80s that was like that sort of shiny, almost glitter, but it's like a specific kind of like 80s shiny glitter that they don't make anymore. Mm-hmm. It's like the credits are done in that font, and everything is colorful, and it's just a fun movie to watch, and it looks great. So anyway, that's my last one. Sorry to drag that out, but I do think Corvette Summer is a lot of enjoyable stuff, and definitely worth a pickup if you're into that kind of thing from Warner Archive. So
nice.
So that will do it for this round of new arrivals.
That was an exciting stack of discs.
Yeah, both our stacks were quite varied. I'm very happy with the group of films we talked about. There's so much good stuff here for you to pick up. I mean, there's a lot of must-owns in both our piles, I think. So Hopefully there's something worth grabbing for the listeners. I'm sure there will be. We will be back in less than a month's time to discuss more stuff.
Yeah, already thinking about it.
Me too. So anyway, thank you, Rob, as always. It's been a pleasure.
Thanks, man. Always fun to talk movies with you at least once a month.
I agree. I love it, and I look forward to it every month. I was actually not having a great day. I told you off mic about some stuff at work that's going on, and I am in such a better mood after this discussion.
Oh,
so
likewise.
Thank you for improving my demeanor. I appreciate it.
You got it, man.
Everybody have a wonderful and Blu-ray-filled week, and we will talk to you very soon. Bye-bye.
Thanks.